That's he asked me yesterday. He's like, you got any questions or anything? I was like, I'm a free baller.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
I just, like, go for it.
So we're here with, it's me, Ryan, and we're here with Wes Logan. Wes, how are you today?
Good, good. Glad to be here. Glad to be sitting here on the podcast with you boys.
The I Won Practice podcast.
I Won Practice.
Yep. So doing good today. We're glad you're here.
Yeah.
How was the drive, first of all?
Our drive wasn't bad. It was, you know, it was Nashville traffic coming up 65. But, you know, like I said earlier, we're full-time truck drivers and part-time fishermen, so we're used to it.
I'm pretty sure Tim Doobie said the same thing when he was here. That's the truth.
Yeah, I mean, you can ask any of us. Like, we drive more than, I mean, I spend more time in that truck seat than anything. I know I spend more time at that in my bed, for sure.
So, good drive today. You just drove from this morning to here?
Yeah, I got up at I think I got up at 2:30 and left the house by 3 and then kind of just made my way up here. I figured I would hit traffic and slow me down, but it held me up longer than I thought, but it is what it is.
Caught it at a good time.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah. Absolutely. I got to looking at it, and the closer I got to Nashville, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to hit this perfect. Like, couldn't have hit it no better.
Anymore, right. There's never a good time to go through Nashville. Nashville's just growing so much. And
last few years has been awful.
Yeah. Like you said earlier, it's about like going through Atlanta.
Yeah, it really is.
You come
is.
Through Atlanta at 10 o'clock in the morning and get held up just as much as at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, the only way that I can go and not get held up by anything is going west. Like, I really don't hit anything till probably Texas, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you can go through Atlanta at like 2 a.m. There's no traffic, but everyone's still going like 110 on the on the interstates.
There worries. There's been traffic. Or it's like you said, you'll be going through there with a boat or a truck and trailer, and all of a sudden there's like four Hellcats going by you going like 150. I'm like, whoa.
All of a sudden you're in a NASCAR race.
Yeah. Probably one you don't want to be in either.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So I want to jump into it. So you just finished up this year, finished 35th in mm-hmm. Angler of the Year. Pretty good finish, I would say. I wanted to get your thoughts on this year's finish.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we made the classic and that's always the goal. We had a really bad start to the season. I was in a bad place mentally, headspace wise, just with all everything that was kind of going on with the forward facing sonar stuff to start the season. Cause me and a couple of Aaron's had done so much coming up to the start of this year cause we kind of felt like we saw what was coming and, you know, it just kind of, obviously the Toledo Bend tournament played out that way, the Fork tournament, and I was just kind of in a bad place. Rolling into the Florida swing, kind of just had a heart-to-heart, me and my wife did, Riley, and got my head straight and kind of just said, I'll go do what I do and let, you know, the chips fall where they may. And things just started clicking. Like the Harris Chain tournament, I had a good practice, fished the way I wanted to, had a good tournament, rolled to the St. John's. After the first day, I was in like second or third fishing. I was just fishing really good. And then just basically, I had a lot of momentum basically all year. I mean, I was fishing the MPFLs good. And then we went up north, which I normally have a little bit of a struggle with, but we got to Champlain and I had a really good practice, like all 3 days. Thought I could catch like about 20 a day, really. First day went out there, did what I thought I could do, had 20 even. And then, you know, rolled into that day two at Champlain. And then kind of obviously everything happened with the accident. But to be able to, what happened, get to the hospital at Champlain, the firefighters, EMT, get me to the hospital, they get me taken care of, get me back out there with an hour to fish. I only had four that second day. Get out there, get to fish. I catch one more, almost a 3-pounder, that when it's all said and done, we do the points, and that one fish saves me 28 points in AOI, which is monumental considering how, like, I finished 60th in that tournament where I would have finished 88th. So that's a huge, you know, point swing, and then rolled to St. Lawrence, and I haven't had a great history there. I'm having to fish out of a barred boat. You know, I'm busted up pretty good, hurting. Not trying to make excuses, but it just wasn't an ideal situation.
Right.
And was able to, you know, catch enough to stay above that 40th cut line. Obviously, would have wanted to, you know, finish higher. You always want to do better. But the fact the way everything happened to still make the classic is, you know, it's a blessing for sure.
Well, we're excited to see you at the Classic. We're glad you're going
to
be there.
I'm excited to be at the Classic. Don't get me wrong. But going up north, like, it was almost like, I mean, I think we had done the numbers. Like, I had to average like a 75th to finish, you know, right there on the cut line. And I was like, I've done that every time I've been up there. Like, that shouldn't be. I've not done great, but I thought I could do okay. And like I said, I was fishing good. Day one went like as planned, and then, you know, kind of everything fell apart, but we were able to, you know, have enough support and help, and we kind of, you know, limped through it and crossed the finish line.
Right.
With the weights being so tight at Champlain, the fact that everything that happened and you still finished 60th, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Just being real.
Yeah. And that's what I was trying to get, like, not really everybody to understand, but I knew in my mind, like, I know what 5 ounces can do at Champlain, sure, let alone a whole nother fish, whether it's a 2-pounder, 4-pounder, whatever. And just the way it all played out, it was almost like a movie, really. I mean, I can't really remember how all the details played out, but it was kind of crazy.
So I can't imagine Lake Champlain was your most favorite place to fish this year. I would just just a hunch that I have, of this last year, what was your place to be like, yeah, I love coming here, this is the place to fish?
Oh, I really like the St. John's. It's been really good to me. I've probably fished, I think we've been there every year. I've been on the elites, except not maybe one, but I've cashed a check every time we've been there in an elite tournament. I almost won a BFL regional back in, I think it was 2014, which I qualified to go to the All-American, which was up here at Kentucky Lake, but finished second in it by a couple ounces, was leading 2 days after that. It just, I don't know. It's always made sense to me, and it's got really big ones in it, and it's fun to fish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a bunch of big ones in there. But that place is kind of interesting, you know, and you're going there for the MPFL this year?
Yeah, actually, I leave next Saturday to go down there. We'll start practice on Sunday.
That'll be interesting, being in the fall.
Yeah, the fall is, like I said, I've only fished there once in the fall, but we took out of Palatka, and I actually caught them in Lake Crescent, which we're going out of a place I've never been as far down the river. We're going out of DeLand, Florida, which you won't have time to run to where I caught them that one tournament. So I don't really know how it's going to fish. I mean, like you said, there's giants live in that place. Like, you could catch a 10 pounder on any cast. But fall fishing is tough anywhere, so unless you're up north, but it'll be interesting. But I mean, I get to be on one of my favorite places and, you know, try and figure it out.
I'd say, I mean, what are your thoughts on that tournament? Is it going to be tougher tournament, obviously, being in the fall and being in the south?
Yeah.
Or is it going to be a slugfest?
No, I think the winning weight will probably be pretty heavy, just because of what lives there. But I think if I had to guess, like going into practice, I'm going to be expecting it going to be hard to get a bite.
Yeah.
But I think if you can figure out a deal to get a few bites, even in practice, if they're like in that BFL in the fall, I wasn't getting many bites. But I caught like a couple decent ones, but the last day of practice, I caught an 8.5-pounder, and I'm like, well, I've got a bait they bite. I know what they're kind of relating to. I've caught a bunch of little ones, a few good ones, and one great big one. You know, you can get a big bite doing it, so you just lock it in your hand and kind of fish. That's how fall fishing is to me. You figure out something you can do and then just wait for a big bite and hope and pray for it.
Sure. And I think this is just an assumption, based on kind of seeing how you fish and everything. Do you prefer it to be tougher? I mean, are you a slugfest guy?
No, I hate slugfest. I've done well in some, I don't know how, it just kind of unfolded that way. But I grew up on the Coosa River where you grind a little bit, you know, it's a pattern place. I don't know. I mean, the slugfest are fun, but when you have a different mindset, when you put your boat in the water, you know, you got to go catch 25 to even be in the top, you know, top 20, to where you go to a grinder, you're like, man, if I catch 1 3.5-4-pounder, it's like, it's going to jump me 30, 40 places. So that's, I kind of like that aspect of it, because you got to be mentally tough during that. And it kind of takes some guys out of it automatically when you get into a tournament like that. So I feel like I kind of excel and stuff like that, just cause I grew up fishing that way. Like, I just know how to be mentally tough about it.
That's kind of how I am. I mean, I'd much rather be tough. Like, I don't hardly ever do well if it's going to be a slugfest. And like, you look at guys like Van Dam, like, he's the first one that pops into my head. Mm-hmm. I feel like he was good no matter what, didn't matter. But like, he was a guy that if it was going to be a slugfest, he was just going to catch more than everybody else.
Yeah, he's going to be the top of the slugfest.
Exactly.
Like all your guys are catching them really good and he's catching them great.
Yeah.
Like,
and he did well in grinder tournaments, mm-hmm, too, of course, you know, like that classic up there at Pittsburgh, whatever.
That's right.
You know, but he was just one of those guys that if it was going to be a slugfest, every time they came here in June, and they're catching ledge fishing, you know, on a crankbait and everything else. Yeah. Like, he was just going to catch more than everybody else.
Yeah. And I think one thing, and I don't know, I've never talked to Kevin personally, but just watch the way how he fishes. A lot of times in a grinder tournament, those guys that really excel in a like slugfest type deal, a lot of times they catch them off a place.
Yeah.
Like they'll have one place. Well, in a grinder tournament, hardly ever are they in one place. Like, so you'll have guys that they look for that for 3 days of practice and never find it because realistically, it's probably not there. There may be one special place that somebody may find in a certain situation, but a lot of times it's put your head down and fish to where you get in a slugfest type deal. You find one spot like at a gunner's roller, like here. I mean, they're and it's loaded with 4 to 6 pounders. Like you just sit there on it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's the thing, like the way I fish and like, I kind of grew up fishing. I've never fished down there, Coosa River, you know, but I grew up fishing a river system and it was like, you go fish, you catch one here, you go a couple miles down the lake, you catch one here and you just keep on bouncing around. That's just being that I grew up doing that. That's how I've always liked to fish, you know?
And everybody calls that junk fishing, but it's really like you're pattern fishing, but you're not pattern fishing. Yeah. Like you know what you're looking for when you see it, but you may catch one on a frog, may catch one on a flipping bait, one on a spinner bait. Like, I guess it is junk fishing, but I don't really consider it. Like, I don't look at it as that way.
Yeah.
Because I know what I'm looking for. It's just how do you present it and how do you catch them when you see it?
Absolutely. So kind of going off of that, for next year, is there anything on the schedule? You've seen the schedule, anything on the schedule that kind of catches your eye that you're looking forward to?
Yeah. I mean, obviously where we're starting out at in Florida, like we said a little bit earlier, be starting on St. John's. It is tougher there that time of year. I really enjoyed fishing there this past year in April. It seemed like a lot of fish were biting. A lot of fish got caught. It's a little tougher then because it's far enough north. You still have a lot of that cold weather from the winter. But the Florida swing is always fun. Man, I like fishing the Sabine. I'm going to be honest with you. Like, I really do like it. You catch a bunch of fish. Obviously, they're not very big, but you're going to go out there and get, you know, 20 to 30 bites a day. Now, they may all be 12 inches, but like I said a little while ago, you catch a 4-pounder there, it's like an 8 or a 10 anywhere else. So, you know, if you can figure out how to get that one bite, you're going to jump yourself up. And it goes back to it's that grinder type tournament, stuff like that. I really like lacrosse too. I did very well there in the Open when I qualified for the Elites. It's a really fun place. They're obviously fishing the Open. I think they started there today, but it's a fun place, frogging, flipping, you know, there's a big smallmouth in there too. So it's kind of got everything for everybody in a river setting.
Sure.
But yeah, that's kind of,
it's a fun place up there.
Yeah. The, that unknown about that, I don't even know how to say it. Paqua something, whatever that, that river is up there we're going to in North Carolina.
I hope that's how you say it.
We'll go with that.
Nobody knows.
What did you call it?
The Albemarle Sound,
Yes.
So it's like the sound right off the ocean. And then where y'all are taking off out of is just like a little river that comes off the sound. And has there been any discussion on like where your restrictions are going to be?
I got nothing right now. But just looking at it on a map, I mean, there's a river over here. There's a river over there. But it looks like you have to basically run out into the bay or whatever you would call it to get somewhere. So that'll be something new to me. I've never really done that. I know that when they were going to Winyah Bay, there was some people running to that Cooper River or something. I think they were having to go out into the bay and stuff. So that'll be something different than I've ever done. But the little bit of research I've done on it, looks like they catch great big ones there.
Yeah.
Like, well, giants.
So the Bass Pro Tour this year was at that Chowan River or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's right there. It's like in that same sound area.
Is it really?
Yeah.
I did not realize that.
It's just like a couple rivers up, I believe.
Huh. They were catching some really big ones.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like that was one of those ones that no one really knew what it was going to be like because no one's ever gone there.
Right.
But it played out really well.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like that's a good event to watch then.
Yeah.
It'll be a good one for sure because, I mean, obviously, there'll be somebody that knows something, obviously, and it'll be up somewhere. But for the vast majority, we'll be seeing it unless you go pre-practice for the first time, which I'm going to say the majority of us will go pre-practice that one because you can't just show up on that one probably. I'll definitely go check that out. And I probably won't even get a rod out, just ride and see what everything looks like for when we come back. But time of year should be spot on, I would think. Being there in April, I mean, it should be wide open trying to spawn or maybe a little pre-spawn that far north. I don't know. We'll see.
Well, and it, you know, if all else fails, you can't figure it out. You could always just ask the locals for some information if you wanted to.
Before January 1st.
Yeah. That went away pretty quick.
So that kind of leads me into what I wanted to talk about afterwards. So last week and the week before, Bassmaster, NPFL, and MLF had all sorts of changes. Being part of the Bassmaster Elite Series, what are your thoughts on the changes that they're implementing?
Yeah, I mean, it obviously they think it's the right decision on their part. You know, I don't really feel like the one transducer is going to really change a whole lot. Because I mean, the few guys that have one on their you know, jack plates and stuff like that, they really shined in the smallmouth tournaments, like the bait, like when the fish were relating to bait a lot, like the Champlain and a St. Clair, stuff like that. Like that's when those guys, you know, really excel. Which I had heard that side shooting front looker stuff is good in timber, which we've got a couple timber tournaments coming up. So it may make it a little bit more challenging there. But the guys that are really good with it, the guys that I've fished with, they only need one. Mm-hmm. Like they don't use all that two or three stuff. Like they got one and they know how to use it. They know what they're looking for. But again, the technology's great. Like I hate to be like, I'm not going to be negative about it. It just, I wish we could have done, me personally, I would have liked a half and half schedule.
Sure.
You know, half with it and half without it. Because a lot of us anglers kind of think the same way, is if you want a true AOI for that year, he's got to be able to catch them with it and catch them without it. Like, yeah. And if you want to prove that, that's the perfect way to prove it. You make everybody happy. They get to fish, you know, they'll have tournaments where they don't have to worry about using it. And the fans get to watch, as people are calling it now for some reason, traditional fishing, yeah, or old school, which is just bass fishing. And then you would have people being able to watch, you know, learn about the live scope stuff. So I don't know. I mean, they, like I said, they made the decision, you know, what they thought best was for their business and our league and stuff. So we'll kind of see how it plays out.
That's kind of like with the MLF changes, like on the invitationals being that day one, you can use it, day two, you can't. And then day three for the top 30, they can use it again. I kind of like that. Obviously there's a whole lot going on there. But I kind of like that because you have to either, you know, you can use forward facing, not use forward facing, but you got to endure one day of probably what you want or what you don't want, right, to get to that top 30. And so I feel like that's a good kind of mix, you know, so that'll be kind of interesting to see. And obviously each league is doing something different. Obviously you fish MPFL stuff, mm-hmm, and you know, they're just saying, let's just make it easy, cut it out completely.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that was a good business decision on their part. Cause I mean, truthfully, if you look at it, what do they have to lose?
Yeah.
I mean, they have no, you know, tie to any electronics companies. And, you know, I saw a few comments that said that, oh, well, they'll never get any sponsorship money from an electronics company. I was like, I don't really believe that. I don't think that was like a, you know, an end all with that. Just from some of the people I've talked to that I know very well and I respect what they say. The MPFL is not dead by any means when it comes to anything in the fishing world right now. They're getting a lot of support, and I think there's a lot of, you know, bigger businesses really, you know, kind of checking in on them, like keeping an eye on what's going on over there, definitely interested in what they're doing. But, you know, like I said, that same thing I said with Bass, they made a business decision that they think is best for them, and I'm going to support Bass, whatever they do. I'm going to support MLF, whatever they do, as long as I'm fishing over there. But it will be a breath of fresh air to roll up to a tournament and not have to worry about it, and have a chance to compete to win with it. Cause I fished majority of the tournaments this year and didn't even turn it on the elites and the MPFL. We still have two more, obviously, but, you know, if you roll up to an elite tournament and there's any chance for there to be some scoping fish caught, that's how it's going to be won.
Sure.
So, yeah, you know, as soon as you know, to put your mind to not going to use it, you're not competing to win more than likely, unless you just find some kind of miracle place or miracle pattern or something. So, know when you go out there and fish the way I like to fish and what I know to do, you're fishing for, you know, 50th to 15th most of the time.
Absolutely.
So it'll be refreshing to roll up and be like, well, I can go, you know, try and figure something out and have a chance to win because everybody's on the same playing field as it comes to that.
Sure. Yeah. It'll be your neck will appreciate it as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
You ain't going to be staring down at that unit so much.
No shoulder brace.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Like if this continues, which I mean, I think forward facing sonar is here to stay. I don't think it's going anywhere. Obviously, yeah. I still think that over the next couple of years, it's kind of still going to be muddy because everybody's still trying to figure out which rules and what applications we need to make it the best. So I think there still will be some changes going forward over the next couple of years. But like if like everything's going to stay the same with forward facing sonar, people are going to be looking at it so much, like what kind of back trouble and what kind of neck trouble are like 15, 20 year old kids going to have when they're 40?
Yeah, definitely going to be some chiropractor still in business.
Yeah, absolutely.
I might go into the chiropractic business. Like, go learn that real quick. Well, not real quick, but go learn that and just quit fishing so I can work on all the I'll just go to every tournament.
Yeah. After just weighing, set up in the service crew.
Yeah, after weighing, I'll just be over in the service yard. Y'all come on. They'll be lined up.
Yeah, that'd be good.
So, needless to say, these rule changes don't really affect you too much then?
I mean, my boat will be rigged exactly the same as it was this past year. I mean, it'll have, you know, I'll have it on the trolling motor and, you know, just where I think it needs to be used, I'm going to go use it. But it's kind of, I've had my hand forced, like I have to go use it if I want to, if I want to compete. I mean, I feel like it was a big part of me making the Classic because we had a couple of tournaments where that's all you could do if you were going to really compete to, you know, have a good finish. And you kind of just have to put everything take everything else out of your mind, like anything, you know, like man, I could go try and flip a dock or go run down a bank and throw a, you know, a horny toad or something. Well, you don't need to go do that. You need, just need to keep staring at that screen and go, you'll run into them eventually. Which is kind of how the Smith Lake tournament played out. I did catch a big bag the second day on the bank, but you know, the day one and day three, I had to do what I had to do. Yeah, I mean, people can call me a scoper if they want, but I'm doing what I have to do to, you know, keep the lights on, pay the bills.
Absolutely.
Well, how hard is it for you to just sit there and scope all day? Because for me, I know like the Toyota Series here this year, the first day I had like 13 pounds and I was scoping. I was throwing a rig over brush and I told my co-angler, I was like, dude, I got to run to the bank for a little bit. Like I just had to go do it, even though I didn't think that I was going to improve my weight, and that's probably dumb of me to do, but like I just had to go throw a chatterbait down the bank just to like break up the monotonous vibes that I was getting.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I would do that in practice. Like I did that in practice a lot. I would be doing it for like an hour or two, and like I gotta go do something, and I'd go and skip some docks or something, or like you said, go throw something down the bank. But in the back of your mind, you know, as soon as you pick that trolling motor up, you're not going to find them. And when it came to I had done that, I really wanted to do that in practice to see if I quit doing it, I would go get a bite.
Yeah.
And it was so hard to get a bite on the bank. I was like, there's no point in leaving, for the most part, unless condition wise, you know, condition set up good, which is what happened on the second day. But talking about Smith Lake, but I knew, like after practice, like keep your head down, just keep covering water. You'll run into enough to, you know, and this is how the tournament's going to get won anyway. So you may luck into, you know, a couple of 4-pounders.
How hard is it for you to kind of block out the memories? I know that's something I deal with a lot.
I wouldn't say touchy subject, but that's the whole thing.
Yeah.
Like forgetting about everything you've grown up learning and like reading conditions, reading the weather, like all that. And like, I'm not going to say it doesn't matter because the fish do act different in different conditions out there, but still you're throwing at a fish every single time you make a cast.
Yeah.
So like it is very hard, being me, like knowing like how I've grown up fishing, running patterns, putting stuff together, where now it's just like, and I've tried to do it using it like, okay, they were on a point and, you know, I'll drop off on a point in 20 foot of water. Well, you go try and find 10 more of those places. They're not there.
Yeah.
Like their only reason they were probably there is bait or something. Like something was right on that place. And it's hard to duplicate it with that, to where basically you just find an area with a bunch of fish in and keep up with them the whole tournament.
Yeah.
It seems to be the best way to do it. And I mean, if that's the way that thing works, then that's the way it works. But it is very hard to, like you said, just forget about everything. And just kind of turn your brain off for the most part.
Yeah. That's like, here in the summertime, like I think about it. There's a stretch of docks and I've caught a lot of 4 and 5 pound fish on it. And like, I know I don't need to be going and flipping them docks, but it's like, but how many big ones have I caught there?
Yeah,
you know,
that's
and
right.
It just, it's hard to find that balance of, you know, adapting to the new technology and the new way of doing things, but also still like, you can't forget about everything. And that's like history as a whole in our world. You know, you can't forget about history. History is an important topic to teach in schools because, you know, history will always repeat itself. So it's good to remember that. But it's trying to find that balance, I guess, is the hard part.
Yeah. And I just wonder if the younger generation of anglers, like the high school kids now, like that'll be, you know, the coming out, going to college, since they've started fishing, they've had it.
Yeah.
They've had the live scope. So I think they're so good with it because that's, they commit to it. Like they know how good they are with it. They know what they can do with it. Why go worry with anything else? Yeah. They don't have anything else to think about. And it's not their fault. I don't blame them for doing it one bit. I don't knock them. And they are better at it than a majority of people. But it's all they've ever done.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they don't have that little, you know, voice in the back of their head. Hey, go flip those docks. Hey, they can, you know, the wind's blowing in on this bank. You might run a buzz bait down. It might be a fish up there wanting to eat. Well, they're not worried about catching one up there. They're worried about finding a group of them out there, you know, throwing in as many dots as they can, you know, the law of averages. But I mean, that's kind of where that younger deal, I think they're so good with it, like I said, because they just, they don't know anything else. Let's go commit to it. And we're going to catch them before the day's over.
Yep.
So a little bit of a hard transition, but I feel like it's appropriate to talk about it now if you want to. Lake Champlain had a little bit of an incident there.
Moment of silence.
Yeah. So can you, if you're comfortable with it, can you run us through what was going through your mind before, during, and after that?
Yeah. Yeah. It don't bother me at all.
Okay.
Just kind of like roll through, like, if you don't care, like the tournament, just, you know, day one, this is what you did.
Yeah.
Went out with a game plan on day two and how day two went.
Yeah. I mean, basically, I mean, day two went about as perfect as it could. I had one little stretch I wanted to start on, was fishing grass lines and like, I don't know, probably 10 to 15 and rolled up. I mean, I literally think within 20 minutes I had like 18 pounds. Kind of bounced around a little bit, went scoping like over some deep stuff, trying to catch a great big one. Didn't really kind of did that for a couple of hours, caught a couple that didn't help. And then I ran back to some of the stuff I thought I was going to really fish and caught 2 4s that got me, you know, right at 20. And literally it couldn't have went any better. Didn't lose anything, nothing. Everything's good. Day two gets canceled, which would be Friday with the tropical storm that came through. Weather was horrible.
What'd they say? It was like 50, 60 mile per hour winds.
Every bit. I promise you it was every bit of it. We went and rode out there. It kind of ironic, or I didn't. Bill Lowen went out to where the ferry crosses and like sent me, he FaceTimed me of like the waves and they were, I mean, it was unbelievable how big they were. Like in his camera on his, from the, like the bank, they looked like they were huge on his camera. And I like, I know them things are big. Like
they always look bigger in person.
Yeah, absolutely. Than I'm like, camera. Oh my gosh, dude. Well, come to find out like, where the accident happens, not half a mile from where he was, you know, shooting that video where those gigantic waves were. But rolling into Saturday morning, started on a place that I thought I could catch a quick 15 pounds. And there was a river that blew in or that came in right there and it was blown out. There was mud everywhere. There was like logs coming out of it. It just was nasty. Left straight from there, ran to a place right above Plattsburgh, caught 4 within like 15 minutes. Like I caught a 4 pounder, 3 other keepers. And I was like, all right, I'm going to go to where, you know, I thought if I caught some, they would be bigger, running across the lake right there. And I started out running, and they were probably, I don't know, 2 footers maybe at the, you know, highest, the wavelength or wave height wise. And I'm running and I take off and I'm probably running 45 or 50 and my nose is kind of down and I'm just beating my brains out going across them. I'm like, I can't do it. They weren't far enough apart. They were too tight together. Like it just wasn't working out. So I trimmed up a little bit and I just said, I'll get up on top of them and just bounce across them until I get to where I'm going. So I trim it up a little bit. I get up to about 58 or 60 and I'm moving pretty good. Like I'm not running fast. Like I'm just kind of getting on. bouncing across them. And all of a sudden I hit one of them. And about the time I hit it, my boat kind of like turns up and like my nose kicks up. Like, why? I remember my thinking, I'm like, why did my boat just do that? Like I've been in this exact type boat for 5 years on the Elise. Like, I know how to drive it. I know what it's supposed to do. I've been in any kind of weather conditions, water conditions with it. And all of a sudden it just like the nose just kicks straight up. And as it comes, like I'm like bracing, I'm like, it's going to hit pretty hard, but I'm expecting it to hit and go straight. Yeah. Like, so as it hits, I mean, as soon as it hits in the video, you know, you can see in the video, it throws me to the passenger side. I can remember, like, as it's throwing me, I'm like, dude, don't go in the water. Like, do whatever you got to do to stay in the boat. Cause I didn't know if like I had broke something or if it was going to knock me out, mm-hmm. like, and all that kind of stuff. I didn't want the boat to come over on top of me. Obviously in my mind, I didn't realize the engine was off of it. I just didn't really know what had happened for that split second, but it's like, everything slowed down. Like, do not go in the water. Like, hold on, grab something, like go to grabbing, whatever you got to do. It kind of comes to a stop. And I don't remember like really any of this. I just from watching the video where it happened, and I'm like kicking my legs for a minute. And I don't think I was hurt. I think I was more mad than anything, like kind of pissed off. And as I stood up, I remember I was like, God, my head's hurting. And I grabbed my head, and I remember the end of my fingertip, like the first section of my fingers, like went into the cut. And I was like, ooh, that's not good.
Yeah.
And like, I remember grabbing it and it was like warm. I was like, damn it. And I opened my eyes and I'm like looking like back, and I remember the motor's like completely gone. My power poles are like kind of mangled and twisted. And I was like instantly in the video, I take my life jacket off, but I think it was more just instinct me of like, every time you get up, you take a life jacket off, get up, take your life jacket off. I took it off, grabbed my phone. I'm trying to get it cleaned off, trying to call Lisa, our tournament director at Bass. I get in touch with her. I get in touch with my wife, who's a nurse, who's kind of, told her what happened, told her where I was hurt. She, you know, keep pressure on it, all this and that. They go start working, try and get a boat to me. All this time, I'm like, I got a rag holding like pressure on my head. I'm thinking like, y'all get me a boat out. I'm like, on the phone, you can hear me in the video. Like, get me a boat out here. I need to get back fishing. Like, I got to catch them. Like, I've only got four. Yeah. They're like, we think we might need to like bring you back, make sure everything's okay. I was like, I'm fine. Like, I'm literally okay. I don't remember saying any of this. Like, I was screaming. I didn't even realize that either. And then Raleigh was like, which is my wife, she's like, send me a picture of your head. And I sent it to her, and it's just like, I mean, it's kind of gnarly. And she's like, called me back. So I'm calling the ambulance. They're going to be here when you get here. I was like, all right, that's fine. They can bandage me up, and I'll just go back out with the loaner boat. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. They're kind of playing.
Yeah. We just need to get him back.
That's
here.
Exactly right. Like, Lisa kept calling. She's like, we're going to get you. I just need to get you back and get you checked out before you can go back out. I'm like, oh, that's fine. So they get the loaner boat out there. It's a guy from Texas Boat World. His name is Jackie. He brings the owner's boat, actually brings it out there. As he's pulling up, I'm grabbing my, I done got me a tackle bag ready. Like, I was going to get in that boat. When they told me I was good to go, I was going. So I got the rag on my head. I'm trying to get him my tackle bag, my four rods, and I got my weigh-in bag, and I'm putting the fish in it. And I don't know how graphic yet. I mean, I don't want to be too graphic, but like the GoPro is like right here, and I'm grabbing them fish out of the live well, holding the bag, and it's just like spraying everywhere in the wind. Blood's just, I'm like, God almighty. And Jackie's over there in the boat, just like he's seen a ghost, like just blowing all over the boat, and there, like a murder had happened. I jumped in his boat. He got in my boat. It's about a 7-minute run back to Plattsburgh in his boat. And that's the worst. That was the worst pain in all of it, was driving back by myself in those waves, like beating, like, and the waves weren't bad. It was just kind of rough. It was just bouncing me a little bit like you would in a boat. And I couldn't keep my hand on the cut. I was kind of like moving my head with my hand. And it was, so I round the corner right there at Plattsburgh, I think it's called Cumberland Head or something. You can see Plattsburgh. It's still like 3 or 4 minutes. And man, I was riding. I like, my eyes were wanting to close. It was getting quiet. I was like, I cannot pass out driving this boat. Like, I can't. Like, there's blood like all going down my face because my rags already got soaked. And I finally get to the dock right there, and there's like 15 people on it, and they're just standing there like nobody's saying a word. Just like pull up to it real fast. Somebody grabs the boat, and the EMTs walk around. Everybody, they grab me. They're like, I think there's a video of this too. They're like, how are you doing? I was like, I'm all right. And she grabs the rag, and she's like, you are not all right. Like, not even close. Like, get me over there on the stretcher. And again, I don't remember any of this. I do remember getting in the ambulance and asking how long it was going to take. I do remember that. I don't know if I like calmed down or if I got my bearings back after driving in, because I'm telling, like, it was like I was that close to passing out. It was, I was just like leaned over. I was like, I can't, I got to stay away. Like, I got to get over there. They have no way other way else to get me. They got me to the hospital, you know, rolled me in. They did a fantastic job. Everybody, like, you know, jumped on board. Kind of told them the situation. I kept like telling them, hey, I need to go. Like, I need y'all to do it. Like, I need to get out of here. And they're like, yeah, we'll get you. And I got the PA, which is the physician's assistant, kind of like the guy that was in charge of everything. I was like, dude, look, here's the whole deal. And I spilled out everything. Like, you know, what we do, the classic, the AOI points. I got 4. We can have 5, all this. And from then on, they like, you know, got kicked it into overdrive. I think 2 nurses missed their lunch break trying to help me. I mean, so I have to be very thankful for them. They got all my scans taken care of. Everything looked okay. Got me sewed back up. Cleaned up a little bit, not really. I didn't want to take no time to have to clean my hair or nothing. I don't remember going and getting in the car. I don't remember going back to first thing I really can remember is taking off in the boat. And I get about 200 or 300 yards running, and I guess all my adrenaline left because everything on my body was like, my ribs, my legs, my head, my hands, like everything was just aching, you know, like screaming, like, hey, dude, you got to stop. I had one place I thought I could go to and get a bite. I knew there was a bunch of fish, but I thought they were small. I ran straight to it, dropped the trolling motor. There's a dot out there. Second cast, I caught it. It was a 3-pounder. And I had about an hour. I fished. I caught 2 or 3 more that didn't help. But after about 30 minutes, I was pretty much done. Like, yeah. I was struggling pretty bad. I came in, weighed in, you know, thankfully. Nobody knew what happened. You know, I got in. Everybody was, you know, how all that kind of goes. But yeah, that's pretty much the whole thing. But as fast as it happened, like it was like I know something. I don't know exactly what happened because it all happened so fast, obviously. But when that boat went up in the air like that, like the boat wasn't supposed to do that. I don't really care what anybody says. Like, I was there. I've driven a boat more than I've driven a car.
Sure.
Like, in my life. Like, I know kind of what I'm doing. And I know crazy things happen, like something could have happened. But it was definitely a freak accident. And I'm lucky to have survived it, because it could have been real bad real quick. And, you know, obviously I said it a lot and I'll say it now, that leash has a lot to do with why I'm sitting here talking to y'all today. And because literally the only thing holding that motor to the boat was a leash and one steering cable. One steering cable broke, one was holding it, and the leash was the only thing holding that motor to my boat. And the motor literally ran up the right side, or up the side of my right power pole. Like, it was doing everything it could to try and come in the boat. And I think what a lot of people don't understand is when an outboard comes off of a boat, the way the propeller's running when you're going forward, it wants to kick the motor across the passenger side. So it's basically going to come over the port side of the boat and come starboard side. Like, so it kind of goes clockwise. Well, the way the boat threw me was to the port side where the motor would have came, and I would have met it face to face at the gunwale. And we probably all know how that would have ended. So, I mean, I basically owe my life to that leash on my boat.
Yeah. And, you know, there's been obviously the Facebook warriors and everything, that they've got a bunch of stuff to say. And, you know, there's been people that have said, you know, that this was just a sponsor plug and all that kind of stuff. And obviously, I mean, you reached out to me because of a mutual friend, mm-hmm. Justin Atkins, yeah. A few years ago. Because you felt that it was important to run a leash. You know, this isn't something that we set up and said, hey, you know, you need to run a leash, here you go. You know, it wasn't anything like that. You know, you took it upon yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and we had talked about it earlier, that we were going to an Elite Series tournament at Santee Cooper, and the week before a guy had passed away from that exact thing that happened. He hit something, motor come up into the boat, it obviously killed him. And I mean, going to a tournament the next week out on a lake that somebody just got killed on from hitting something, like, you're trying to exhaust all avenues to figure out how that, if you were to hit something, don't let that happen to you. And if anybody knows anything about Sandy Cooper, like, it's treacherous. Like, it's, yeah. There's stumps everywhere. Every square inch of that lake is a stump. So, I mean, it just made sense. There was no like, hey, send me all this, give me all this money for this. Like, there was none of that. It was like, hey, Ryan, I want to run this because I want to save, like, you know, I want to be as safe as I can, take every precautionary measure I can to keep me safe, to come back, you know, because at the end of the day, it's just a fishing tournament.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, we want to come in. Obviously, we make our living that way, but we want to do everything we can to come back to our family.
So I think something that you just said there is kind of eye-opening. You wanted the leash because you were going to Santee Cooper, which is shallow, got mm-hmm. a bunch of stuff to hit, all that kind of stuff. You know, and Brandon Cobb reached out at the beginning of the year. He was wanting to get a leash as well because he said, well, we're going to Toledo Bend and Lake Fork this year. Mm-hmm. He's like, obviously two places that you could hit something. And nothing happened at any of those lakes, but something happened.
And look where it happened.
Something happened at Lake Champlain, the deepest, most natural lake on the whole entire schedule.
Yeah.
You know, and that just goes to show you, and we've had conversations with, you know, customers and everything. And it's like, well, I don't need a leash because, you know, my lake's a natural lake. There's nothing for me to hit and everything. You don't know.
No, you have no idea.
You don't know what's under that water.
No, I mean, I mean, how many times does a tropical storm go through, you know, Vermont and New York? And I mean, the floating dock, the submerged dock that they got from where I was at, that was all busted up. There was, I personally got told by three different anglers that saw different ones in different sections of the lake.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and if anybody knows anything about lakes up north, and if you don't, there's normally real small floating platforms like that float out in the water, and they have wheels up on the bank with a wooden platform connecting the wheels and the floating platform. So when it ices over, they can pull it out of the water and it won't be frozen in the water. Well, that platform that's connecting those wheels and that floating platform is what broke loose with the big waves. Like, they're not connected by a whole lot, just a little hinge, I believe. So, I mean, it makes sense. And like, you would never think that. Like, you never think, man, there's something floating out here in 150 foot it on Champlain. Like, you're all, like you said, running around Fork or running around Toledo or Santee. Like, and that just goes to show, like, literally what you say. It could be anything at any time. Like, you don't, I mean, it's the risk we take, but if you're going to be out there taking the risk, why not do everything you can to prevent something, you know, terrible from happening?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just like we call it a seatbelt all the time. And, you know, it's the same thing as putting a seatbelt on when you get in the vehicle. You know, it's actually, you don't have to think about it because you just put it on one time and you're done with it. You know,
literally. I mean, I think we talked about it. I think I got it in 2001 and it's 2004 now. And I literally all I do is unbolt it, put it on my new boat every year. It literally takes 5 minutes. Like, it takes longer to get the tools to put it on than to actually put it on. It's so simple. There's nothing to it. I mean, it's really a no brainer. And basically, I mean, it's a one-time purchase for the most part. People's like, oh, it costs, you know, $300 or $400. I'm like, you've got an $80,000 boat. Yeah. What's $350 or $400? Like, I don't understand that.
And what a lot of people don't realize is $300 or $400 in the grand scheme of things costs a lot less than going to the hospital immediately after and just paying for the EMT ride to the hospital.
Correct.
Like, the EMT ride is going to cost you $2,000.
Yeah.
Alone.
Yeah, absolutely. Or, I mean,
or worse.
You may not get an EMT ride.
Yeah.
Like, you may have a ride in a hearse.
Yep.
Like, and then you've got your family that has to deal with all that stuff. So, and I mean, the majority of people that fish have a family, have a wife, have kids. Like, you don't want to leave them with that.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Well, and like you said, you know, generally when we see these accidents happen where the motor flips up into the boat, because of the rotation of the prop and everything, it's going to end up over there on the passenger side. Well, you know, obviously we're, you know, all these guys are big, bad and tough, and you can't tell me how to be safe and all this kind of stuff. Well, a lot of times that's your wife, your kids, you know, that's
mm-hmm. your buddy, your fishing partner.
Exactly.
You know, you have a co-angler or a marshal or a camera guy, somebody you don't even know.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you're the one operating and it's your boat. Like, I wouldn't want to have to live with myself to know that, you know, I could have tried to prevent something, you know, from somebody else getting hurt in my boat if I'd have had that.
You were fortunate enough not to have anybody else in the boat.
Oh, it was a blessing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, and that's the next thing. Like, I promise you, somebody's going to have an argument. Well, you know, he might have got thrown out of your boat if he was with you, you know, but well, okay, that's what my boat did when it happened, but at least I know the engine ain't going to hit him.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, if, you know, whatever happens, I can't help it, but I know for a fact my engine's not going to come up there and, you know, end it just like that.
Yeah. Like, the best thing that could happen is that person gets thrown out of the boat, right? Like, that's the best case scenario.
Yeah. I mean, it could always be so much worse.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That, you know, we were talking about the story about the guy that hit the old bridge here on Kentucky Lake when the water was up, and that he went under the bridge, cut the corner, hit the cross members that were just underneath the water and threw it up, landed right on top of the co-angler and killed him, you know, and that's obviously worst case scenario, and worst case scenarios happened. You know,
I mean, it was a blessing that mine didn't turn out that way. But like I said, that, I mean, it's basically the reason, like, I mean, the motor came off the boat and there was only one thing holding it from sinking to the bottom. So what stopped it? Right. It's kind of self-explanatory.
So I kind of want to go over. So whenever we published that you had been in that accident and you yourself had said, you know, the leash saved you and what you had said, we had all sorts of comments about how, you know, your boat was running 90 miles an hour.
Which, you know, on that, how fast does your boat go? Fully trimmed out, just a little bit of chop, like perfect conditions.
Like perfect conditions.
Going.
I would say loaded down, like the way we load them down in a tournament, live well's full 66.
Thank you.
Yeah. Got it.
That's because on a good day.
That, all the comments. Hey,
that's had the wind in my back. Got some current going. Like, I'm rolling, buddy. I'm going 66.
Huh? All the comments I see are, if you wouldn't run 80.
Yeah.
Like, 80 was, I don't know where they picked the number 80, but like 80 was the number I kept seeing.
My boat doesn't go, can't go 80 on the interstate behind my truck. Like, I mean, it just, and there obviously are some bass boats out there that run faster than skeeters do. Skeeters aren't made to run fast. They're made, you know, they have a great ride. They're great boats.
How many guys on the Elite Series go 80 mile an hour?
None, zero.
Exactly.
Not a single one. There may be a handful of boats on the entire Elite Series that can run 75.
Yeah.
You're telling me of a field of 100 professional anglers, not a single one runs 80.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
How crazy.
It's shocking, ain't it? Yeah, huh. Very shocking. There's a guy right now in his basement of his mom's house typing so fast his fingers are burning, saying that we're all wrong. That he's done it 100 times going up Kentucky Lake. He's run 80 mile an hour against the current. So
it's the same guys that'll tell you not to do it, right? Like,
yeah, it's I don't know. Like I mean, the stuff that I've read that people have written in the last 3 weeks is just incredible. Like, the way people think.
Well, and it's got to be a little, I say a little, but quite frustrating for you, because you were the only one in the boat and you were there to experience it. But all, you know, 150 people in the comments section go, you know, with their expertise, they were obviously in the boat with you when it happened.
Yeah.
And they know everything. They know exactly what happened.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. Like, the people that matter know.
Yeah.
Like, they don't really mean anything to me. I've really not even responded to them. A couple of them I have, like, that were kind of like really bad, like tell me that I should have died. They wished I would have died, you know, couldn't have happened to a better person, stuff like that. I'm like, yeah, you probably need something said to you. But I will say, on a lot of the bad comments, some of them that were like that, I had a lot of people defending me.
Yeah.
So the support's really great there. So I really appreciate that. But man, like I said before, I know how to drive a boat. I know what I'm doing. Like, I don't really care what anybody says, to be honest, because at the end of the day, let's say I was going a little too fast. I mean, okay, I still don't need to die.
Yeah.
Like, that's no reason to be killed. Like, yeah. I just can't understand that with people. And I mean, maybe they're just so miserable with their life, they want somebody else's to be too. And they like seeing somebody in pain and stuff. But I mean, either way, if me wrecking and having all that criticism and stuff is worth somebody getting their life saved, I mean, I can definitely handle it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so one of the things that you had talked about when you were on Mercer's podcast, I think he brought it up, you know, and to kind of back up here, like, we had one conversation up to this accident, really. I mean, we had a conversation about the leash when you got the leash. That was really it.
Really about it.
Yeah. You know,
3 years ago.
3 years ago.
Yeah.
And so obviously I heard that this happened. I texted you
that
night and I was like, hey, hope you're doing good. Heard about the accident. You need anything, let us know.
Yeah.
You know, and that was it.
Yeah.
So then obviously, you know, we've kept in touch since, and you did that podcast with Mercer while you're still up there at Champlain. And so we hadn't even talked about, hey, we need to get together and do this podcast, anything like that.
Yeah.
He brought up a question about, you know, your thoughts on the leash being mandatory in tournaments or on bass boats and everything like that. And what were your thoughts on that? I mean, what did you kind of,
talked about that? Yeah. I mean, I remember having the podcast, but I can't remember exactly what we talked about. But I mean, I can talk about that. Like, I don't see how, I know, let me back up a little bit. I know that I'm real close with my boss at Yamaha. And I know he's in talks with some guys. I think they were looking into trying to start somehow to figure out how to make it mandatory on a Yamaha, like any Yamaha pro have one on their boat. I don't know if that's kind of gotten any traction or not, but I don't see how it would be so hard for like the major boat manufacturers to get them, at least, I hate to say to us, because we're not special. Like, we're just out there trying to do a job, but we are on the water more than the average person. And maybe because people follow us and pay attention to what we do and the stuff we use and all that, like, I would wonder if maybe us having them on our boats and more people seeing them, hey, what's that? Like, hey, well, it can do this. And then they're like, huh. Well, then they go home and tell their wife about it, and their little girl is running around the living room, and they're like, I'm not going to need to buy one of those just because. Like, if it could just get one person, like I said, like me getting hurt, if it saves one person, you know, it was worth it. So, I mean, dude, you have no idea how many times I get asked what power poles are.
Yeah.
Hey, what's them antennas back there? I'm like, well, it's actually a shallow water anchor, blah, blah, blah. Well, it's the same thing. What's that leash thing?
Yep.
Well, it keeps my motor from coming in the boat if I hit something. That's a great idea. Does it really work? Yeah, it really works.
Yeah.
I promise you, it really works. But just that quick, and they're like, I'm going to look into it. Well, great. I mean, if you fish a little bit, you should look into it. Yeah, I will. Well, I mean, it did its job.
Sure. Absolutely.
But yeah, I work with Yamaha real close, you know, have a good partnership with them. I really want to try and do something about that because, you know, it would just be a good thing to try and do, I feel like.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and that's, we've talked about it before, you know, everyone thinks we make $1 million off of the leash and that's just not the case. Just being honest, you know, we don't have near the margin that people think we do. That people think we're just price gouging and it's $20 worth of material and we're selling it for $350 and,
well, you can make it at Harbor Freight for $100.
Yeah, exactly.
To the comment warriors.
Yeah.
If you want to try that, let me know how it works out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess it's just people that are ignorant and don't know, like maybe they just stay inside all the time or I don't know. If you look at it, like if you know what you're halfway, know what you're looking at. When you look at it, like, I mean, that's stainless steel materials, those brackets, like the hand woven stuff. It's not $20.
That's the thing. So, I mean, we work with a leader in the racing industry. The manufacturer that manufactures the leashes for us, they hand weave all these tethers here in the United States. And they work directly with NASCAR, NHRA, IndyCar, Monster Truck, all the racing divisions. So that when a car hits the wall going 200 miles an hour, it keeps the hood of the car, the wheels from flying up into the stands, whatever. You know, this is something that they're very experienced with. Obviously they make a great product. I think you can attest to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and so there's obviously a lot more that goes into it rather than just going down to your hardware store and picking up the first rope that you see and slapping it on.
Yeah. Look, put a little ski rope back there.
Yeah.
But I mean, to be able to have a product that is used to keep the impact of a 200 mile an hour race car together,
like
to keep a hood from going into the fans and the seats. Like, I mean, what more do you want to know?
Exactly. Right. Yeah. And that was the other thing. So I actually went to the PRI show in Indianapolis with them a couple of years ago. And that's just a racing show. I mean, I was totally out of my element. Mm-hmm. I don't know the first thing about racing. I don't know anything. And I guess it'd be like taking them to the classic or something. But just seeing their products and, you know, they've got products that actually go in side of the wall at a racetrack. I didn't even know this. I thought you just had like concrete barriers going down the side of the wall, but they've actually got products that go inside of the wall that are like tethers to absorb that shock so that when the car hits the wall, it isn't just like hitting a brick wall. Right. Like there's some shock absorption.
It's the impact.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that's the kind of stuff that, you know, they're working on and it's been amazing working with them because they're so knowledgeable on tethers and restraints.
Yeah.
You know, this is what they've done forever.
Yeah. I mean, they work with high impact, you know, fast. I mean, that's,
Yeah. This isn't just something that we're whipping up in the back room in the shop and just slapping a heat shrink on it and calling it something crazy.
Yeah.
You know.
And you can't simulate high impact and fast, you know, like you said, we can't seem to find somebody who would want to sacrifice their boat for our testing.
That's the comment that drives me crazy the most, is, well, let's see it in action. And it's like, dude, I have yet to find anyone that's willing to volunteer their life and their boat and just go hit a stump at 70 miles an hour.
Yeah. Because I mean, what people don't understand is just because you hit a stump and the leash saves your motor, hell, the damn boat could break in half.
Yeah.
Like anything could happen.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, the leash may stop the motor, but everything else may blow up. Yep. Like, I'm not just going to volunteer to try and prove to you, you know, bedroom 202, you know, with an emoji as your, you know, one of them little avatar things as your profile picture. Like, I'm not going to have to prove that to you, bud.
Yeah.
All right. Come on now.
That got me. That's funny.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, Ryan, I don't have anything else. Do you have anything else?
No, I mean, obviously, I appreciate you making the drive up here. Appreciate you stopping by to checking out the facility and talking with us, doing this podcast. And obviously, we wish you luck for the rest of the year, finishing up the season with the MPFL, and wish you good luck for next year. Hopefully we're just going to be talking about the leashes, you know, hey, everyone needs to get a leash. We're not going to be talking about it. Hey, Wes was our test dummy again.
Yeah. No, we're going to try and avoid that at all costs for sure. But I appreciate y'all inviting me. You've got an incredible facility here. Like it's top notch for sure. No wonder y'all make a great product, but again, appreciate y'all having me, and it's looking forward to another good year. I hope.
Absolutely. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Wes.
All right, guys, that is a wrap on another episode. Be sure to follow us on all of our socials, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, TikTok. Send us a DM if you want to hear a specific topic or even a guest. Give us some feedback. Once again, we appreciate you for listening.